Hello and welcome to the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. Now, if you're a regular listener to this show, you'll be well aware that UBS is interested in addressing the big questions that shape our world. To help best answer them, they sought out a number of Nobel laureates in the economic sciences to ask them to share insights, discuss their research, and open their always inquiring minds. This week, in the second in an occasional series of Nobel perspectives, we're hearing from another such inspirational figure, Sir Christopher Pitsiridis, Regius Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics, where he spent almost all of his career. He's recipient of the 2010 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. On the agenda today, the origin story of his fascination with labour markets, search frictions and unemployment, a powerful exposition on the value of human capital, and a restatement of his belief in the importance of lifelong learning. And I'm delighted to say that Sir Christopher joins me now. Let's start at the beginning, Chris. I know you've talked before about the influence that being born in Cyprus has had, some of your early memories, I guess, of things you saw, and the influences, I suppose, that those early days had on your work and the way that you viewed the world. Do you think you have a unique insight that was driven by that story, where you were born, the things that you witnessed early on? Did that shape, I guess it's inevitable, the man you are today?
Well, it's inevitable that your early experiences will shape the things you do later in life. In my case, there are two things that shaped the way that I've thought about the world later in life. One was seeing my father, who left school at the age of 10 because his family couldn't afford to keep all their children in the village. And he went to the city. I mean, the city was Nicosia, of 100,000 people. It was the biggest in Cyprus at the time. And worked for an uncle, then started his own business, and then did well enough. And I could see how hard work is rewarded, how he approached education, which he didn't have. He would do evening classes. And that definitely shaped the way that I was thinking later when I was studying about the labor market and how it works and how people without education can get in, start their own business and progress. But then at the same time, I went to school in Cyprus when there was a lot of disruption to our education. First, it was the independence movement against British colonial rule. Then it was the internal conflict with between the Greek and Turkish communities. And that definitely disrupted the education a lot. And it also taught me something else, which is that capital could be destroyed very easily and land could be lost very easily. But human capital, what you have, is the most valuable thing that you have. And it's not destroyed easily. You can make use of it to progress, to go somewhere else. And really, that had a lot to do with me coming to Britain as well. When I finished my studies, it was the worst period to be in Cyprus. There was the Turkish invasion, war, many missing people of my age. And I decided to come here and pursue a career. By that time, I had the PhD to pursue a career in at universities, do research, and until we could see what would be the best thing for me to do in future. And I'm still waiting to see what would be the best thing for me to do in future.
Well, I think it's worked out pretty well. Let's see. You're a very, very modest man. Let's talk a bit about, you've already actually reflected a little in that first answer about this idea of the particular aspects of sort of markets that you've looked at. Most notably, we look at sort of search theory and some of these interesting, I don't know how to describe them to a lay listener, maybe sort of imbalances or this strange meeting where, for example, you can have unemployment, but there are jobs available. I guess, is that question something you quite quickly identified as being something that would be central to your life's work? Because it seems so, I don't know, it's like a crazy situation almost to the lay observer.
Well, that's precisely what motivated me, in fact, when I was a student. Because when I was a student, unemployment was very little. When I started my studies, unemployment was very, very little. It was only about 2%, and people were getting into the labor market very quickly, finding jobs. And the way economists were thinking about it was that you have either unemployment or job vacancies, but not both, because if you have the job vacancies, workers will take them, and unemployment would come down. But then later in my student career and especially when I was thinking to start a PhD, suddenly unemployment started going up. This was in the late 60s, early 70s. And there was a lot of writing about it in the economics literature, but nothing really that explained what was going on. In fact, people were pretty clueless, in fact, as to why unemployment would be going up so rapidly. You know, from 2%, it went up to 5%, I mean, which is, you know, doubled or more than doubled. And then at the same time, there were job vacancies. So amongst the politicians, there were people saying, well, why aren't workers taking these vacancies? They're available. There are jobs available. Why are they unemployed? And again, there were no answers. Some of them would say, oh, it's because, you know, they're lazy and they don't want them. Maybe they get enough income from welfare support and unemployment benefit. Others would say, oh, because of housing problems, they have to move house to get it, and council housing is not easily available for the unemployed somewhere else. So I thought, you know, this is a problem that needs explanation, and I started working on it. It's, I mean, to the layman, it might sound an easy enough problem, but it kind of contradicted everything we knew about the economics of unemployment up to that point. We just didn't know how to think about it. There was no framework in which we could put unemployment and job vacancies and think, except for some vague or short statements made in the past, most notably by William Beveridge in his in the book that set up the welfare state, in fact, in the 1940s. He mentioned something that later on people drew in a diagram and called it the Beveridge curve, and still call it the Beveridge curve. But that has been absolutely central, explaining what Beveridge was saying, what the Beveridge curve was saying, absolutely central to my research.
And I guess there's something interesting here, which struck me at least, and I know you've spoken before about the kind of human element here, and there's a human connection. You've talked about people finding work and how that market operates as being almost more, or having things in common with, say, other human relationships, which are explicitly emotional and not at all economic in character. Is that one of the things, perhaps, which made other economists before you less receptive to looking at this space, because those kinds of things are quite understandably more difficult to quantify? Mm-hmm. They're not just ones and zeros. There's mm-hmm. a bit of a kind of an X factor about it.
Well, I mean, precisely that, because if you think about unemployment, a person suffering unemployment is one of the two or three worst things that could happen to them. There is death of someone very close to you, divorce, usually, not always, and unemployment. Those are the three big shocks, if you like, in your life that will make you very unhappy. And yet, as an economist, you have to step back and look at it in a cold-blooded way, in a kind of mathematician's way. You know, you want to write down some equations, some numbers and symbols that will tell you what's going on. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge that it's something that involves the emotions of someone. It involves decision-making in very difficult times. There are many pressures on the person who is unemployed. You might say, am I not wanted? Am I not capable of doing anything? Am I running out of money? And combining those two, it was the most difficult thing to do in both in my research and when others were working on unemployment. The way economics evolved, it started off by descriptions of what people do, and then became a little bit too abstract, where the human element was missing entirely. I mean, Keynes was probably the last economist in 1936 who tried to bring it in by saying there are psychological laws on how people behave. But after that, people reduced it into what he himself called the pretty diagrams or pretty symbols of theoretical economics. And that's what I tried to do, really. I tried to bring in what I consider to be the important factors that people look at when they lose their job and they're trying to find another one, and the factors that they look at when they are in a job that they're not very happy with, and they're trying to study the market, if you like, and consider moving out. And the essence of economic modeling is that you have to strip it down to its essentials so that you can write it in a simple model that statisticians or econometricians can put numbers to it and tell you whether it's significant in today's market environment, or whether it's not.
And I can see, and we can hear this fascination with the human side of it, trying to incorporate that into the modelling. And you even began by talking about your father, this amazing sense of the transformational power of work and of what that can do for people. If we come a little bit more up to date, Chris, how is that transformational power changed, or how's it evolving when we consider new technologies? Because this is something I know you've also written about and you talk about frequently. People talk about AI and robotics and all the rest of it. The pace of change seems to be faster than at any time over the last 40 or 50 years. Now, that may not be true. But how is technology shaping that transformational power? Is it changing what it is fundamentally, or does that stay the same?
Well, technology, of course, is changing work all the time. Sometimes faster, sometimes not so fast. But if we look back at the beginning of industrialization, which started in Britain late 18th century, then you have sort of gradual changes in the world and technology taking place. And then suddenly a big shock arrives that changes everything. You know, the big shocks in the past were the railways, the steam engine before electricity, I think, was the biggest shock of all, actually, in my view, even more than robotics. And now we have more and more automation, digital platforms for trade, robots doing the work that human beings were doing. The pace is faster now. But another feature of what we have now is that we have machines, basically, that can do a job better than human beings can do. It's a sort of thinking job, not a manual job where you know, obviously an electric drill can drill a hole in the wall much better than a human being can do without any use of electricity. But that's a kind of manual job, and we can see why you need more power than the muscle power that we have. But now there seem to be tasks that require more brain power, if you like, than we have, and they're provided by machines. And that's what's making people panic, that you know, I studied at university, I've been doing, I can do my job very well, and then suddenly my employer or another company comes along that uses artificial intelligence and big data and comes up with better answers than I do. So what do I do? You know, that's the threat that people are facing now. I'm generally positive about the outcome of these new technologies, but there will be transformations in the labor market, and they will be big. And we have to be prepared to accept those, to see how we can make best use of them and how to move on to different types of jobs within the next 20 to 30 years.
You talked earlier about still learning, still being hungry to add to your knowledge, learning, you know, in a great seat of learning where you work from day to day, of course. What about inspiration? Is that where your inspiration comes from, or do you sometimes need to check out altogether? Do you go for a wander, I don't know, near your home up in leafy North London, take a stroll, I don't know, Hampstead Heath, look out across the city? How do you sort of give your mind a break and get some fresh inspiration? What does that time look like?
I do that, actually, funnily enough, sort of seeing the changes that are taking place in my local labour market, because, I mean, as you know, London is so big that there are small markets and communities here and there. I mean, I do enjoy walking down my high street and seeing what new shops there are, what people are buying, how they are buying, you know, how much is being delivered in brown boxes with a word beginning with an A, most of them written on the box. Recently, though, most of my inspiration comes from traveling abroad in sort of different ways. You know, I mean, obviously, most of the inspiration and the sort of the eye-opener is going to China and seeing how that country is transforming itself. Before this big Chinese takeoff and growth, if you asked an economist, they would probably have said, oh, you know, you cannot have growth without a liberal democracy and openness and transparency and open market. Well, they don't have it, and they're growing very fast, and very soon they're going to overtake the United States as the biggest economy because of their population, but they will still have the size. And I think that partly the reason that the response of the United States to what they see in China is confused and contradictory, depending on who is in charge and what they think about it. And it's not good for the world, actually, either, but that's an aside in a way. So that's one. But then I also get inspiration when I go to countries like Denmark, for example, and I walk in there, because I was there recently, and walking their pedestrian ways and seeing how clean the environment is, what they're doing, how different they're doing it from us. Because I always admire the Scandinavian countries, the way that they run their social programs and their employment and their health and care and so on. And seeing the sort of, you know, I call it the post-industrialization phase, in that what you care more about in those countries and what we should be doing more in our countries is not be obsessed with rates of growth, with the number. Is it 1%? Is it 2%? But be more concerned about the quality of growth and the quality of life in terms of the environment, of the working environment, of the physical environment outside, in terms of the provision of social services, fight against poverty. And it's one of the reasons, in fact, that I never felt very comfortable being in the United States and thinking of settling in the United States, when all my colleagues that achieved something in economics would go there, because their universities are obviously very, very good. You know, go to Harvard, MIT, Stanford, whatever is, you're at the top. But I don't like just to be in the ivory tower provided in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and not look outside. And you do see poverty there, which, I mean, I would feel so ashamed to see that on my doorstep, actually.
Chris, it's been really wonderful speaking to you. I'm certainly glad, speaking as a Londoner, that you've stayed here for so long. Maybe as a final thought, do the same big fundamental questions. We kind of started by talking about what prompted you to study, to move into this area of expertise, even as a youth, and the experience of watching your father as a young man and the rest of it. Do the same fundamental questions still preoccupy you now? I don't know. It's funny. If you were starting out in your academic career now, do you think you would take a different course? I always find it interesting, you know, can reflect over what, sort of 50 years of extraordinary research and writing and all the rest of it.
Well, I'm sure I would go for the big question always, because I think that's where you can make a real contribution. And when I started my work on unemployment, that was the big question. Why is unemployment going up, and why are we not understanding it? What are we going to do? Now that's not a problem so much. Unemployment is still there, but we know how to deal with it. I don't want to take any credit for that, but many governments do use the various models and various propositions that we developed in the work with others, and many, many others actually who worked in this area of research. If I were looking at labour markets now and say, what is the big problem in labour markets, I would say inequality. Because the way that technology is changing, and the way the rates of return to capital and labour are moving, there's a shift towards capital and towards the owners of capital. Digital capital, you can see, you know, who are the wealthiest people on earth. And even in countries like China, where, as a less developed country, the wealthy people were the ones who owned land, or that the government made land available to them. But in the last 10 years, you have the internet entrepreneurs, you know, the Jack Ma's of this world, overtaking them. So ownership of capital, digital capital, brings in inequalities in the labor market. You need to own capital to avoid the inequalities. But how can you make sure that workers benefit from that huge, enormous rate of return on capital when all they have is labor? And that's a very, very difficult question to answer. And that's what I would be doing. Many, many people are doing it. I mean, Thomas Piketty, who was a student at the LSE, by the way, I taught him when he was a young man. He said the only thing that can be done is to tax capital. But then taxing capital will make it move to other jurisdictions, and you need to think about how to do it collaboratively. It hasn't been received very well by policymakers. Others, you know, I mentioned Jack Ma. He recently announced that he's going to spend most of his wealth on philanthropy, charitable contributions to educate more people in the Chinese countryside, because he started off as a teacher. Those private initiatives are very important. Bill Gates is doing the same in the United States. At the same time, of course, keeping a nice portion for themselves, but they're doing it. They don't have to. It's voluntary. But we need something more than that. And that's where my fascination with the Nordic countries coming in, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, they are doing it through taxation and the provision of social services, which is probably the best way that we know how to deal with it now. But even there, I found the recent elections result in Sweden very worrying, that suddenly there is a turn to extreme politics, which is driven partly by that and also by immigration. So it is a very, very big question. And it's one that I couldn't start researching now. I can just think and reflect. And we're waiting for very bright graduate students who will come and say, this is what I want to do. And then I can think loudly and hopefully someone will pick up some ideas and go and do it.
Excellent. Well, that's a wonderful note on which to leave things. Chris, great to speak with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sir Christopher Pitsiridis for sharing his Nobel perspectives with us on the programme. To read more from and about the professor and to discover how Nobel perspectives shape the UBS worldview, head to ubs.com and search Nobel Perspectives. As ever, you can listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via your preferred platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.